Welcome to the Bob Siegel Show podcast on the Cross Global Media Radio Network. Visit cgmradio.com/Bob to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform.
The most profound discussions happen in an on-air phone call every few months connecting Wildwood, Missouri with San Diego, California. I'm still getting over the miracle that they've ever even heard of phones in Missouri, but here he is once again by phone, my good friend and rotating co-host, Greg Jarvis. Greg, welcome back to our program.
Hey, Bob. I think. Thank you.
Well, you give me a lot to think about when you come on, so I always want to give you at least a little to think about.
Well, they have phones out here. They have many wonderful new inventions. They have cars, indoor plumbing. It's great.
But maybe you can confirm a rumor. I heard they closed the library down there. Somebody checked out the book.
Oh, well, yeah, we're waiting for them to bring it back. Yeah, it's pretty peaceful out here. You know, I come to California and I can't ever remember. I mean, it just never seemed that busy when I lived there.
I don't think peace and California ever get mixed up a whole lot in the same sentence.
No, I don't think so. Things are pretty hectic out there. So how are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Good, good. Well, we're busy and...
And you moved recently, right?
Yeah.
In fact, this little town I mentioned wasn't even the same town you called us from before, was it?
No, it wasn't. So, yeah, we moved to a different little town.
This one has two books in the library, right?
They're still building the library.
Oh, okay.
It's like support your local sheriff, like the jail cell.
we're going to get the bars in any day now.
That's right. They're going to get the books in any day.
Now, Joe, we have no bars on the jail cell, but we're going to operate just as if the bars were there.
And then you got to love that look that he gave him.
So, well, what's on your radar today to discuss?
Well, I was really thinking about this. When you start to see things crowd out your relationship with God, I begin to question, what is that relationship? Where is that relationship at? What needs to happen for that relationship to become stronger? And so the topic hit me about the difference between being a student and being a disciple of Christ, because I have been a student over the years of Christ and biblical truth, and at times have been a disciple, and sometimes have mixed those up, because a student seeks knowledge and examines, reasons things through, and a disciple is more of a lifestyle and a life commitment. And though a disciple has to be a student doesn't have to be a disciple.
Yeah, and we should say that they drew that distinction in Jesus' day. We always think of Jesus and his 12 disciples. There were actually over 100, but the 12 were the top 12. But there were other people in that era, well, several hundred years before Socrates had disciples. And a disciple was one who, in a sense, almost came under the custody of his teacher. So it wasn't just a classroom situation. Certainly included, I think, everything that we would attribute to a classroom, but it was far more than that.
So there was more of a commitment involved.
Yeah, and they would literally follow their masters around, eat with them, and sleep next to them oftentimes. So what the relationship that Jesus had with his disciples was not unique to the phenomenon of discipleship in those days. What was unique was the message of Jesus and what it was that he was teaching them to do.
So now bring us up to the present period, and churches are to make disciples.
Yeah, most churches don't do anything of the kind, but they would say they're doing that.
So they tend to make more students, wouldn't you say, than disciples?
Yeah, and frankly, I think if you look at most churches, the amount of people that are involved in studying the Bible as opposed to going to some prayer group, and I think prayer groups are important. I think churches need to do both. We need to have a time where we share and pray. But the amount of people that are even students of the Bible, I think's very low. You can tell this just by listening to Christians talk, and often they're quoting their pastor rather than quoting passages of Scripture that they've truly studied for themselves.
So we're moving even farther away.
Well, it varies from church to church. There's certainly some churches that are doing a terrific job. But as a general rule, I don't see a whole lot of discipleship in. They'll get into these exciting programs, and usually the word discipleship will be associated with it. But A, they don't last long, and B, they're not all discipleship anyway.
Well, and so then that would, I mean, from what you just said and from what I've been, you know, thinking and seeing in churches, that's important. I mean, that's huge, especially if the mandate is to make disciples, and if we are to be a disciple. I mean, it's obviously it's a two-way street. It's not the church's job to make disciples against people's will. People have to willingly sign up for
that. That's right.
You know, so it seems like a dilemma, though. I mean, if people aren't even being the student, I mean, if they're being students, they can be severely misled into thinking they're disciples, into thinking they're okay, because I think at our core, at least at my core, at least being married, I want to be justified. I want to justify myself. I want to be okay. I want to be right. I want to be on the right side. I want to have the right beliefs. I want to, you know, and so that's just within me to want that. And so I, when I examine myself, I tend to try to see myself that way, because people don't, you know, usually want to see themselves in a negative light or in a less than light, although I'm try to be honest about that.
No, but we have an uncanny ability to tell ourselves what we want to hear. Absolutely.
Right. And so that's a difficult thing. I mean, we're to examine ourselves, but if we're to examine ourselves and we have this tendency to say what we want to hear and to feel like we're okay.
Well, that's why, like you said, we're supposed to examine ourselves, but be in a situation where others are examining us too. I have a couple of guys that I meet with once a week for prayer and sharing and accountability. And that's very important. And I guess technically we'd call that fellowship because we're all peers. But when I was first led to Christ, the guy that led me to Christ would meet with me to teach me things, but also to pray with me and to hold me accountable. And I think I do think I was blessed to have a very genuine discipleship relationship with the guy that led me to Christ. And I think the best question that a mentor like that can ask themselves is, what would this person's spiritual life be like if I'm no longer here? Am I duplicating myself? Not my personality, not even necessarily my gifts, but am I helping this person to discover his gifts? And that's what the pastor's supposed to be doing. The pastor's supposed to be encouraging the discipleship experience. I think all too often pastors are so satisfied if people are just coming to whatever events that they're coming to and the numbers are up, that it's a feather in the cap and we're satisfied. But the barometer of how much people are growing is not the main barometer churches pay attention to. It's the numerical barometer that they pay more attention to.
Well, and then part of that that's too bad is, likewise, the person themselves tends to pay attention to that. If they're attending, check. If they're...
Oh, absolutely. We go down that checklist.
Yeah, I think that's really a relevant question. Is which one are you? And of course, I always ask myself those questions, student or disciple. And, you know, I guess that's where I find myself.
And again, if you are a disciple, you're both. You can,
right.
Like you said at the beginning, you can be a student without being a disciple. You can't be a disciple without being a student.
Yeah, and the frustration that I have is I've met so many people, and including myself. So, I mean, I really don't want to turf this off onto other people as if other people are the ones with the issue. I'm the one with the issue. Sometimes I fall back on what I've learned as a student, the knowledge, the reasoning, you know, to affirm myself and to feel like I'm okay and I'm justified and where I should be because I, you know, have the right answers and I believe the right things. And but what's lacking in those moments of life is what the disciple has. And you had mentioned it previously with the gentleman that you meet with. There's relationship and there's accountability. And
that's right.
I think those two are probably very key and probably would help people in determining, you know, where they're at. Which side of that coin are they? Are they truly a disciple and being discipled and living that commitment? Or are they merely, and I'm not saying merely like it's, you know, second class, but you know, God's not calling us to be just students.
Yeah, it's interesting because in the book of 1 John, he said one can't really love God if they don't love their brother too. And I think that goes into the area of commitment and accountability too, where people would say, oh, I don't need to make myself accountable to people because I have this relationship with God. But we can play interesting little mind games with God. God is invisible. We know that if we're Christians, his spirit lives inside of us and runs his thoughts through our thoughts. But a lot of times we can play little games and not always truly decipher which thoughts are coming from him. It's not too hard with me. If a thought's a little more mature and has a better attitude, then I figure it probably didn't come from me. But we don't expect God to speak to us with an audible voice. He can. He did that from time to time in biblical days. He does that from time to time today. But that's not generally the way he talks. His voice is more subtle. And so with the invisible God, let's say somebody was making a commitment to pray with God every morning or pray with God every night before they go to bed. If they don't do it, they're not really expecting God to do what a human being would do, which is slap you on the shoulder and say, hey, missed you last week. Where were you? And that's why I think we need the human element. Even though our human friends are helping us to get closer to God, it is the church, the people in the church that are God's arms and legs.
Well, and when we're around those people, it's not simply the relationship or simply to be around, but it's to be around sharpening each other and encouraging each other and challenging each other and engaging in a dynamic relationship that does involve a level of accountability. Because sometimes we get lost in those relationships, too, and think, well, you know, I have this Christian friend, and this is a strong Christian friend over here, and you know, blah blah blah. But the actual relationship isn't a cutting edge relationship. It's not one that's challenging or edifying, other than just simply getting together and enjoying each other's company. And some would reason, well, wasn't that from God to enjoy each other's company? And it's just like you say, the mind games about who's talking to us, ourselves or God. But also, we can play mind games about where we stand.
Absolutely. We both come from the same ministry. We did campus ministry together at UC Santa Barbara. And you remember we had what we called agape groups, where anywhere from 5 to 7 people would hold themselves accountable. I remember one of the students, I heard this story. He had just shared that he had wanted to commit himself to have a quiet time with God every morning, early in the morning, but he wasn't doing it. And he asked people to help him out. And they started taking turns just calling him in the morning and getting him out of bed. Now, probably annoyed him at times when they did it, but that's what he had asked to do. Other times you hear stories of people that are having trouble with pornography or something. And so a friend will come in and put on some deactivation device on their computer or something that blocks it. And people doing very tangible things to help in the walk that they have with God.
Yeah, it's those tangible things. I think when we, when we make it kind of just in our head and things that aren't tangible, just sort of a sense that, well, and I'm not going to pick on Baptists, but that's my background.
I'll go ahead. I'm an ordained Baptist. You can just pick on them all you want.
Well, it's one of the groups that really points back to a particular day and time that they accepted the Lord.
Right, right.
That is their badge of honor, and that means I'm a Christian, and it's like, I don't know. I remember Jesus saying that God could make these stones, children of God, and it's just we point ourselves to just ridiculous things sometimes to justify ourselves. We don't want to. A lot of times, we don't want to be justified.
I mean, right, and we should point out that even in Jesus' discipleship, when he was feeding people and healing people, he was drawing a big crowd, but when he would start talking about discipleship, when he would say, if any man would come after me, let him take up his cross daily and follow me. He who finds his life will lose it. He who loses his life for my sake will find it. The crowds got very thin. Jesus had trouble with his numbers. And all he did, instead of chasing after these people and saying, well, we're going to have an afterglow, we're going to have punch and cookies, we're going to have a rock band, he just turned to the disciples that remained, and he said, do any of you want to leave too? And they said, well, where would we go, Lord? You have the words of eternal life. And so even with Jesus himself, and I'm probably not going out on too much of a limb to say that Jesus probably discipled people perfectly. And yet, like you said, it was a two-way street. And when it got more practical, when it became a call to action and they weren't just sitting and listening and being amazed by Jesus anymore, that's where the crowds got thinner.
Right. And I felt that. I felt that, too. I mean, fortunately, when I hear truth, I actually feel, which is an awesome feeling, I actually feel a drawing. I actually feel drawn to that kind of language, that kind of imagery. And that's just the first step of discipleship. Sometimes the part that's difficult is that accountability. I mean, it's kind of like a fire. You, you know, you're drawn to the warmth, and that's nice, and that's the first step. But guess what? When the fire starts to go out and you have to work at it and you have to go out and get logs and stoke the fire, and you know, sometimes, you know, there's more to it than just being drawn. But that's a big part, because the opposite of that happens all the time. People, like you said, are repelled by it and turned off by it. They really just want their basic needs met.
Yeah, and we assume somebody else is going to be the one to stoke the fire. It's kind of interesting because I used to have a standard in my Bible studies, and I did this more with the students, the college students, where I would say, if you're expecting me to be here every week to teach the Bible study, I'm going to expect you to be here every week. I was a real stickler for attendance.
The expectations that people would have of you as a teacher, and you put that back on them.
Exactly. It's a two-way street that they would tell me why they can't make the study every week, and yet somehow, if it was a week when they could make it, if I said I couldn't make it, that wouldn't go over too well with them.
Right. So it seems like that then also is another aspect of that discipleship. There's accountability, there's relationship, there's expectations, and well-communicated expectations.
Yeah, and it wasn't the kind of thing where if they missed one week, they had to come with an excuse. It was just like, look, you're on your honor before God. If you don't show up, I'm going to assume you had a good excuse. But let me tell you ahead of time what I don't consider good excuses. And with college students, the sacred cow is always, I have to study. I have an exam. With older families, the sacred cow is usually family. Well, I need to spend time with my family. Now of course, a student needs to study. Of course, family's important. And that's one of the reasons I tend to resist priority lists. But first there's God, then there's family, then there's work, then there's leisure. The problem is when you put things on a list like that, it makes the word God on the top of the list meaningless, because God is supposed to be a part of all of our lives. He's supposed to be a part of our family, part of our leisure time, a part of our work. And so rather than having priority lists, I encourage people to say, what's the priority today? If you made a commitment to be in a Bible study, barring some emergency, that is your priority. It doesn't mean it's more important than your family, but it may mean it's more important than your family this particular hour, because right now this is where you're supposed to be.
Yeah, and I think that we, again, I think that goes back to us kind of feeling justified ourselves, that it's not, we give up, and I don't know if that's just an American thing, you know, because of our culture. Commitments are so fleeting, and we give them up so quickly, where other cultures sometimes... commitments are much more weighty, and I think that might play a part in it, but also we justify ourselves, and we think, well, you know, this is important, but I'm okay whether I go or not, and we don't see the implications of treating it lightly. And like you say, God is supposed to be even more than a part of everything in our lives. He is to be our life, and everything we do is out of that relationship with Him, ideally. But again...
Yeah, if you're listening in, none of us live up to this ideal perfectly. So Greg and I are not claiming to be perfect disciples. We're just pointing you to what the process is, and we are committed to that process.
Right. And it's an ideal that I think we need to keep in mind, because we sell out so quickly to something less than the ideal, and we feel okay about it. And you know what? It's kind of like, you know, when Jesus was telling us that, you know, if you, you know, you say you haven't murdered, but if you hate your brother, you've committed murder in your heart. Now, you say you haven't committed adultery, but if you lust in your heart, then you've committed adultery. So our response to that a lot of times is, okay, well, I won't do those things, and I won't think those thoughts. Okay, so now I'm good. And his message is, no, you've done it. You're not good.
And it's not just saying I won't think those thoughts. How do you not think thoughts? How do you keep a thought from just passing through your mind? Well, then we might say, well, depending on how to focus on the Spirit and what our prayer time is like, we might be able to set up some spiritual barriers. But see, we need help with that.
Right.
And we need somebody to say, hey, I've been where you're at. I've struggled with the same thing. Here's what I did. And that's where we're getting to the heart and soul of discipleship.
Well, and that's so important, because we don't naturally go that direction. We naturally go the other direction. We're naturally heading in a wrong direction, or a direction that's not godly, and need that that help, that assistance, that discipleship, that commitment, that relationship, the expectations. And so I think it might be something that we can answer the student or disciple by what's in our life and what's not in our life. Because I think we answer the question sometimes by looking at what's in our life, but oftentimes what's in our life is right thinking, not a lot of wrong behaviors, some right actions, and the bulk of our life not, you know, really hurting anybody. And so it's like, you know what? I think I am okay. I think I am a disciple. And it's, and yet what we've talked about so far with the words that have come up, accountability, relationship, loving your brother, there's expectations. It's as if there could be a list of things that we could actually look at and not again, not checking them off the list, thinking, yep, I do that, because that's not really in the spirit of a discipleship relationship. But I don't know, is that helpful, do you think, to some people to understand that some of these things would be in the life of a disciple?
Well, of course, because people need to hear some examples. We can't just say discipleship and leave them guessing what it means. So I know we want to resist the checklist, but there's nothing wrong with saying, well, here's a list, and it's not exhaustive, but here are some examples of the kinds of things we mean when we say discipleship.
Yeah. Well, now, if those things aren't present in someone's life, and so and yet they know Scripture like the back of their hand, and then they do show up on Sunday, and they do show up on Wednesday, and they do go to the potluck, and they do make a tasty dish, which is nice.
Vegetarian dish or quiche does not count.
No, that's not even a dish, basically.
And it certainly ain't tasty.
But if they're doing these things, I'm just wondering how to move from self-justification over to discipleship, and I'm thinking it has to start with the person. It has to come from within. That it's got to be personal. It's got to be tangible. It can't just be, you know, stated as such, I'm a disciple of Christ, and there's no interaction in someone's life. And so it sounds like one of the first steps, or a very important step, of course, the first step is to examine yourself and to see what is and isn't in your life. And then would be to move toward this personal, tangible, accountable relationship with another who's able to disciple. Now, I don't know. Sometimes those people are limited. Not the person themselves. I mean, the number of those people.
Well, that's why there may be an advantage in having a multiplicity of people. That's why I like these accountability groups, these agape groups, because one person might be able to advise you based on their experience where somebody else can, but I don't want to overemphasize how much experience somebody needs. We make such a big deal out of that today, even with pastors. They've got to go to seminary. They got to have a degree. Boy, I'll tell you, I have a seminary degree. Well, you do too. How much practical advice did we learn about how to disciple somebody at seminary? It was a graduate school. I learned a lot of theology. I learned some good stuff. It's an education that I'm grateful for. And I love staring at that degree on my wall. It makes me feel all kinds of good things about myself. But you know what? It didn't do jack for helping me to become a better minister. Really didn't. So I don't want to overemphasize that. You don't have to be a professional to disciple someone. It's as simple as saying, this is how far I've come in my Christian life. And I have a long way to go. But however far I've come, I have traveled that journey. And I'm going to help somebody else to make it to at least as far along the trail as I am.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Bob, because we do put a lot of expectations, and we judge people. I mean, frankly, we judge people. Unfortunately, we judge ourselves much more lenient than others, and then we judge others kind of harshly and set up some unrealistic expectations. But again, it is important because we tend to judge people based on their level of likability, how well they speak, maybe how quote-unquote successful they are, whatever that means.
You mean in terms of whether judging them to put them in a position of leadership?
Well, either leadership in the church, but in our own life. In other words, if we're going to step into discipleship, if we're going to look at this, if I'm looking at this and going, wow, Greg, you're living more as a student than a disciple. You need to get out there and live more as a disciple and seek to disciple others. The first step is that internal movement. The second step would be to look for an accountability relationship with a group of men, a group of women if you're a woman, and then look to that group to make sure that it's capable of discipling. So there's going to have to be some judgments made and some thoughtful consideration, I would think.
And then your concern is that as they're making those judgments and the thoughtful consideration, they might go too much with credentials or appearance or how
right.
polished of a speaker they are.
Exactly. And, you know, I've read...
Are you an actual minister? Why should I trust you? And, of course, by the way, the word minister in the New Testament is used of everybody.
Right.
The New Testament does not acknowledge a professional minister. We're all in ministry. There were people that were financially freed up to do ministry full time, that we had that, but everybody was called to be a minister, whether they made their living through making tents like Paul did, or whether they were actually paid like Peter was.
Right. And so we are called to do that, and yet we still look at others and put some unrealistic expectations, or we view them, we show preferential consideration. I had read a book a while ago, and it was about being an introvert. It was a phenomenal book and talked about how we tend to show preference toward people who speak well, people who are energetic, people who look a certain way. And the people who don't, especially those who don't speak a lot, they don't seem to be dynamic, the introverts, we shy away from, and we think, oh, you know, maybe less of them, when really some of that quiet spirit is phenomenal and can be very influential and terrific in our lives.
Yeah, and it depends. There are some people that just emotionally are not very socially adjusted, and they may not be in a position to disciple anybody. But on the other hand, like you're saying, just because somebody's quieter or more reflective or more melancholy, that doesn't mean that they don't have a lot to offer. They might have a lot more to offer, in fact, just from being so reflective and being so observant of human nature.
Mm-hmm. I think you'd have to talk with a person, and rather than look at them from the outside and look at the externals, which we tend to gauge and judge many people, including ourselves, on, to get a kind of a feel for their relationship with God. I've been amazed sometimes at some of the gentlemen in my life. When you run across a person, and when I was much younger, it hit me with older men, and it wasn't just by nature of being an older gentleman. I mean, certainly when you're older, you're oftentimes more mature. I'm hoping to get there someday. But it was more than that. When I ran across a godly man, you could just tell in their speech, in their demeanor, but I mean, they still could have a terrific personality. They may or may not be energetic or outgoing or talkative, whatever. But there was a spirit about them, and that came across in dialogue, and it really stood out. And I think we should look for something like that. And again, not some checklist or whatnot. I think if God's moving us towards someone and we talk to them and spend time with them, I think it can become apparent as to their walk with God and their relationship with God, and that it needs to be more than simply a getting together time. Because I know, I've been in groups with guys that sometimes it's just getting together.
We had a guy named Chris here at UCSD. He put together a specific kind of group. He picked the shyest, less talkative guys in our group. And we were a group of a lot of big talkers. Chris was a little quieter, a little shyer. And I'll never forget after he met with them a couple of weeks. And these were all people who were just known to be in a room of people and hardly ever say a word. He says, boy, you get these shy guys together and get them talking, they can't shut up. and they have all kinds of interesting things to say. I also wanted to comment on the very insightful comment you made about respecting the elderly, because we are a society that does not respect the elderly like they used to. There's a line in the Jewish Talmud that says that if a person hears the law, the Torah, instructed by his own grandfather, it's almost like having it instructed by God himself. That's what a glorious thing it was.
There you go. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Culture is not geared toward the elderly.
Not anymore, but there was a time when it was a very glorious, respectful thing to be older. And I think we baby boomers, we're that generation known for detesting the idea of getting old. And we tend to glorify youth.
Right. We do glorify youth unless they are the outstanding ones, for example, like Betty White.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, and I love how they break down those stereotypes. But I'm always hearing, particularly when an election comes up, listen to the youth. The youth knows. Get out there. I said, the youth doesn't know jack diddly squat. I'm not listening to the youth. I didn't know beans when I was in college, but I thought I knew everything. It's a very ineffective combination.
Well, I think we're substituting wisdom for wisdom. We're substituting knowledge. And today's youth has so much more digital knowledge, digital abilities, that they seem in some ways smarter and wiser, but it doesn't equate.
Yeah, in fact, when we were talking earlier about Bible study attendance, it would be interesting if we could take a survey to see if Bible study attendance weekly has gone up in proportionate to people having DVRs so that they can go to the Bible study and not miss American Idol.
Yeah, it's funny, the things that we value. I mean, and I'm not here to tell people what to value. Absolutely not, because I lead sort of a different life. But I'm telling you, there are so many things out there that can distract us from not only what we're here for and the primary relationship in our life, but distract us from the discipleship relationships in our life, if they're there. And if they're not there, there's lots of things to fill that. You know, one of my favorite scriptures, you know, and then I always forget exactly where it is. I think it's 44, I don't know, Psalm, is it 44, 64, 60?
Oh, if you're talking about the Psalms, it could be anywhere. That's a long, long book.
Thank you. But it's be still and know that I am God. And then it goes on from there. But that whole concept of being still, and you know, where we move to, we are out in the sticks, and you go outside, and you know, it is quiet.
If you look at a lot of the people in the Bible, a lot of the great leaders like David, like Moses, they had times of great solitude, herding sheep or being in the backside of the desert before their ultimate calls from God came about.
And I just think there's so many things that crowd in, as if we need help. We, you know, we go seek out a lot of stuff, but there's so many things now, and our youth get so many things, and there's lots of stuff to fill our lives with, whether it's visual or auditory or, you know, just time. There's so many things that vie for our attention that it makes this discipleship thing become even more difficult, because we think, oh, commitment, okay, maybe once a month, maybe I can get together once a month, which, hey, that is better than nothing, but I don't know, that's, you know.
But there's no consistency. You need to do something at least weekly, even biweekly, it never works. I've been in Bible studies where they say, hey, let's start meeting every other week. I said, we can do that if you want, but it'll be the beginning of the death of this Bible study.
Yep.
Because
yep.
What happens when a person misses 1 week? Well, now they're not going to be back for 3 weeks.
Right.
and there are times when you have to, it doesn't work. You have to have at least a weekly commitment to something.
Well, and partly because of our human nature. I mean, we're so quick to forget things. We're so quick that's why we take up our cross daily. It's partly because it's a daily relationship, but also because of our human nature. We're so easily gotten off track that we need all the help we can as often as we can. And it's just so easy to kind of pacify ourselves with all that we have going on, especially now. I'm just so amazed with all the... I took an Apple iPhone class this last weekend, and the guy was so excited, and he's like, I just don't understand people that come in and they say, you know, they only use their phone to call and text. And I sat there, and I'm like, oh, because that's all I use my phone for. And it's an old used iPhone, and the only reason I got it is because it was less expensive than replacing one that I had broke, just a cheap like flip phone.
Well, and basically life as people know it is on that iPhone now. It used to be that we had all these different devices. We'd have a television set, a telephone, a movie projector, a movie camera, a stationary camera. It's all one device now.
Well, and that's the comment he made.
It doesn't yet toast our bread, but I think that's coming out in the next Apple.
Yeah, I think that's an application. There's got to be an application.
It's the special toasting app, yeah.
But that's true, and that's what he said he did. That's how he got into it. He couldn't afford a computer and a mobile phone, so he got an Apple iPhone when they first came out, and he did a lot of his papers on that.
And it's kind of uncanny that all of life, as somebody knows it, is in this one device in the palm of their hand.
Well,
because what happens when that goes off the grid?
Yeah, if that goes down or we get a sunspot that blows everything out. But, I mean, it's like a hammer. A hammer can be used for good. A hammer can be used for evil.
Oh, sure. I mean, I have one. I use it. But, boy, we can get far too addicted to those things.
Well, and I think it can take our attention. And I think we can almost be mesmerized away from some priorities in life.
The Bob Siegel Show podcast is a production of Bob Siegel and Cross Global Media. Visit us online and subscribe to the show at cgmradio.com/Bob.